I'm Ram Parameshwaran. I'm the founder of Octahedron Capital. And this week, I am panicked about China and Uber.
What's happening?
Nanabuto.
The exciting... God, the Adderall just kicked in. Hang on. It's just that moment where it kicks in. You're like, oh, finally. Because I was just feeling lethargic. I had like half a sandwich. And I just was in the moment there. Yeah. I have this crazy itchy rash. And I had to go to the doctor yesterday. And...
Just don't show me, okay?
No, it's not even visible. Like, I'm just a chimp. I'm scratching myself, and I'm like, I'm not peeling. I know it's late of the sun. So, you know, you get on Google, cancer. No matter what you search on Google, medical, you read far enough down the line, could be cancer.
Well, just
I went in because I had hemorrhoids. There's no way I have cancer.
Get used to the idea.
It's unbelievable cancer. How many I've got cancer, according to Google, and all I searched for was rash. So I had to go to the doctor yesterday, and I felt really bad because, you know, COVID is out there, and we're somewhat in denial of it, and I don't know why, but Phoenix has been one of those cities that just like it didn't happen, even though it happened, and I was at the doctor, and it's August. And the world came crashing back down to me. It was like, they didn't want to see me. You know, it's like Phoenix. I'm like, okay, I'll go in, no mask, whatever. And right. It was just like, why are you here, dude? Yeah. Like, you know, it's a rash. And I'm like, dude, I Googled it. I might have cancer. He goes, listen, I got to go to the hospital. COVID's out of control down there with unvaccinated people. Like, he said that off the cuff.
Right.
Right? And that's not fake news.
Nope.
He's a young doctor. And it threw me off because it's like I am in some kind of discomfort. And he threw a cream at me that was not over the counter. But I truly have some skin thing from too much sun. It's not sunburn on my arms. And you Google it and it was something.
Oh, man.
And so that's a little vignette from Howard's life. But it's a quick reminder that the doctors are out there still dealing with, like, the hospitals are still out there dealing with overflow. And... it's not resonant because you see the stock market and you see other things and it's like everything's rosy.
Yeah, people are just getting sick of the whole thing and I think they're trying to get back to
their
lives.
But the doctors aren't and the nurses aren't and the hospitals are fucking overrun.
They see it.
And so there was a reminder to me yesterday how lucky we are. And I'm probably going to be forced to get a booster here soon, which is fine. The today's guest, Ram P. He's okay with me calling Ram P., because it's just the name is beautiful. I can't pronounce it after all these times. You can say it.
Parameshwaran.
Yeah, so Ram P is back on. I think people will have to go back and listen. I don't want to go back into his history because why? That's why we had him on the first time. And those people that make the hump to the second time, now we can just talk about the future and other stuff. So I follow Ram P on Twitter. He's an incredible mind and share of ideas and themes and trends as he runs a hedge fund. He was at Altimeter Capital, which is one of the biggest crossover funds. He left to strike out on his own. He's had tremendous early success and track record. And he's out there sharing. And I wanted to catch up on the market. As I say, when we do these now, it's like, I don't want to talk about the markets, but if the right person's on, and there's enough stuff going on, I want to talk about the markets. And right now, there's a lot going on. And Ram knows a lot and had some positions in China. And that world just got, you know, reset. So I want to deal with that. He wanted to talk about Uber, and we'll talk about the market. So let's dial him up. Ram.
Hey, Howard. Hey, Knut. What's going on, guys?
Life is good. On cue, you know, we asked people what they're panicked about. And I think I liked, first of all, I want to talk about these things anyway. So I love that you brought up China. Uber was is a curveball. I don't know what your position there is, but I have some strong opinions. loosely held about the stock because I did well as an indirect investor early on, but I don't own the stock right now. But let's dive in quickly with just State of the Union. You are just introduce yourself one more time and then just tell people about Octahedron.
Of course. Thank you, Howard. So for who was listening, my name is Ram Parameshwaran. I am the founder and CIO of Octahedron Capital. We are a global crossover fund, around $250 million in assets and increasing month over month. And our mission is really to be the best partner to the world's best internet scale businesses. And we invest across the public and the private markets in internet payments and software. This week, I'm really panicked on two things. I'm panicked on China, where we have a significant exposure. And I'm panicked on Uber stock, which is not performing. So that's on top of my mind.
So let's talk about it because, you know, I read you and I have my own thesis and then I got it wrong. So my China to me is now like Mexico. It's like, you know, once, twice, three times, stop. It's off my fucking list. I'm not smart enough. It's hard enough to invest. Then you throw the government in changing rules. And it's like, well, if that happened in the United States, we'd all be so fucked. So China is pulling that maneuver. But for me, what got me over the hump in China, the last 3-4 years when I finally just bought a couple Chinese stocks in my 8-to-80 portfolio was like too big to cheat. Like my thesis was, I don't trust anything in China. Been there, done that. No offense, but like, don't need it. Everything looks like the wild, you know, you peel back one layer and then you see the real China. But Tencent and Alibaba were so big, so good, so profitable, so genius, so untouchable that like they're too big to cheat and they don't need to cheat. Therefore, and if you remove Jack Ma, there'd be a revolution. Go. Could I have not been wronger? And China's government has stepped in and rearranged the chairs. So I now have taken it off my, just don't even want to look at the tickers because I don't trust anything. So how does someone who has exposure to, real exposure to China, I know you say you're panicked, but what does it really mean?
Yeah, I use the word panic loosely because it's a play on your podcast. But yep. I would say I'm more frustrated than panicked about China. So number one is, the media understanding of China is so completely wrong, it's not even funny anymore. Mm-hmm. The Western media understanding of China. So I thought I'll spend some time demystifying some of the views out there and why we think they are wrong and how we're kind of positioned ourselves. So what's interesting is in China, you're right, it's very hard to invest there. And part of the reason we've gotten so comfortable is I'm a China analyst. I've been covering China, investing in China for almost a decade now. And my partner, Chris Uskey, comes from Tencent's investment team. So between us, I would argue we have close to 20 years of understanding China. And, you know, part of our diligence was, you know, monthly, if not bi-monthly trips to China and just see what's happening on the ground and making sure we cross the T's and dot the I's. But even we were surprised at the ferocity and scale of regulation. So let me demystify a few things. Mm-hmm. Number one, the regulation that kind of took place in a very short period was always going to happen. It was a constant drip, drip, drip in for many, many quarters, frankly, probably going back 3 or 4 years. And then finally the dam broke and basically the government decided into the 100th year anniversary of the CPC that let's just reset this once and for all. So number one, the regulation should not have surprised anybody. I think the intensity and the targeting and the focus in a short period of time is what took everybody by surprise. Number two, regulation is going to be the new normal. And I'm going to argue to your listeners that the regulation that China is doing is actually very good for the country. Number three, everyone takes the case of Didi and then kind of extrapolates that to the rest of the Chinese internet market. That cannot be more farther from the truth because Didi is what I call a repeat offender. They have been violating norms and requests for data for years at this point. So it's a one-off case and it's not a rule applicable to broadly China internet. What we were taken aback is the worse than consensus rules on education, where the final outcome where all these companies were effectively socialized was something we did not expect. But even that, you know, if you put it from a China context where it is a pretty miserable rat race for young kids in China, and where it's a tough environment to grow up in. It's probably, I would argue, the right thing long term. And by the way, the pushback and the regulation on the after school tutoring was applauded by parents in China. So the government did the right thing for its people. And so what I would say is, I would actually say, unlike Western consensus, we actually believe that China is highly investable, but there are four or five things we need to keep in check and in our mind before we invest in China. So number one, right? This is the most important one. You have to take the goals of the Central Planning Commission very seriously. They actually, you know, all the regulation that was out there that came together, they had fully signaled it and talked about it for quarters, if not years. Nothing is new, by the way. It's just that most people got, I would argue, less paranoid, and they assumed that it won't actually come, and it came. So the steady state going forward is expect what I call more good regulation. And I'll talk about what good regulation means. Number two, from an investment perspective, it's quite straightforward. Number one is, when it comes to China, we always had a higher margin of safety to invest in China for all the reasons you've talked about. But investors should aim for an even bigger margin of safety, right? So if, for example, you expect to make 20-25% on an American stock, you got to make 40-45% on a Chinese stock to make it worth your while. Else, why bother? Number two, you know, multiples for almost all companies, and including the large caps, will likely stay compressed for at least a couple more years. I think people are being too overconfident or probably too sanguine that things will just come back quickly. I don't think it'll come back quickly. I think low multiples are here to stay for at least an year, if not 2 years, till these recent wounds end up healing, right?
Yeah, I mean, even if I'm
wounded right now.
Even if we're wrong about that, like, there's just too many other good opportunities to pay up for what just happened. So, yeah. Keep going.
Correct. But what happens is, over time, you'll see that if you look across the entire market, for relative to its growth, which is still very high, and relative to its quality, the multiples are so cheap, the stocks are so cheap, it doesn't, you know, you have to take a bet on those stocks recovering, because at this point, many China stocks are, including Alibaba and frankly, even Tencent, are trading at effectively distressed multiples at this point in time. Right. So there is a argument that in certain cases, very specific cases, and we'll talk about specific cases, that the baby has been thrown out with the bathwater. And that is where, you know, stock pickers like us, where I have no clue where the market is going, I care about buying great assets on sale. That gets me quite excited.
Got it.
Number three, you know, in all your models, we're actually baking in between 300 and 500 bips of what I call regulatory impact on margins. Because if you're a content business, for example, you now have to have tens of thousands of people out there doing content moderation, which wasn't the case before. So you have to bake in some SG&A margin compression over the next two or three years at least. And number four, I would say that, you know, the VIE structure under which American investors like you and me invest in these Chinese companies, it seems safe for now, but I think it is important that we all move our dollars to Hong Kong over time and trade Hong Kong for the same assets. So maybe instead of owning Baba stock in the US, you want to own 99.88 in Hong Kong, but that's very similar to now owning 700 HK for Tencent in Hong Kong versus owning the ADR tracker in the US. So those are the four or five things I would say. But again, the pendulum has swung well way to the negative side, that I actually believe that there is no quick fix here. I don't think the stocks rally quickly anytime soon, but this is the time where we are actually leaning in versus running away, frankly, and getting greedy and accumulating certain shares in specific companies.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who manages a lot of money and now has seized some opportunity, they've laid the cards on the table. The rules have changed. And you're saying when the rules haven't changed, they just are enforcing the rules that were shown. I think we had 4 years of Trump where it was all blather and all stick, or all talk, no stick. And
right.
China always was like, here's the stick, and decided to use, you know what I mean? Where like Trump would just blather and the Chinese stocks would go down. And that's where I think I got lulled into you know, not truly understanding what I owned at some level. I was just like, they're too big to cheat. That was my thesis. They print money, stocks will go up.
Howard, what I would argue with Trump was back when Trump was threatening a trade war with China.
Right.
Yes, there are kind of like that effectively what he was doing, a trade. Whenever he talked about a trade war, Chinese stocks would sell off. That was the
But
theme.
They would recover very quickly.
And so they would recover very quickly. Yeah. But the reason they recovered quickly was after people realized that it was all talk and it was all blather for the most part. It wasn't serious. I think also people realized that most of these Chinese companies have, especially internet companies, they are unaffected by what Donald Trump said. So it was a sentiment change, and the sentiment came back because at the end, whether it's a Baba or a Tencent, well, Tencent is slightly different because a lot of their long-term equity value creation comes from investments in the US. But for Baba in specific and for other Chinese companies, they are fully dependent on the health and growth of the local Chinese economy. Whether there is a trade war or not, it really doesn't affect Alibaba.
Correct.
So generally Chinese stocks were affected by sentiment and people saw through that very quickly. And so the stocks came back. My view is now the sentiment in China is the worst I've seen in almost a decade of covering China. This is the worst I've seen.
Within China or with, you mean investors within China or just?
Across the board. I mean, remember, there's always kind of this. I've actually never seen a situation where Chinese investors and Western investors think differently. I would actually argue that Chinese investors are much more kind of risk off quickly. They are more trading oriented. So in many ways, observing what the Chinese local investors do is a good, and we're usually a few months late to whatever they do, and they're usually ahead of the curve. But I would say that they were risk off and very nervous for many months.
You're right. It's not like these stocks were acting well for the last 3 months.
Correct. And in certain cases, it was idiosyncratic, like Alibaba. But remember, many Chinese stocks peaked in February of this year. Correct. It was actually go-go time in China. In fact, all these education companies, and a couple of them were outright frauds, in my opinion, they were doing really well. I just think right now we've come to a point of extreme despondency. And we're now what I'm seeing is the whites in people's eyes. And my old boss would always tell me that, Ram, invest when you see the whites in people's eyes. And mm-hmm. I would argue that whether it's Chinese investors or American investors or Western investors more broadly, everyone is grumpy. Everybody hates it. Everyone is nervous to even, touch the water because who knows if it's poisoned or not. And so that is almost a setup where I think it is smart to lean in and be a little more strategic.
All right. Well, I'll let you do that for me as an LP. I agree with you and not seeing the bat. I mean, I agree with you. Like there is no pin action, as Jim Cramer used to say, right? Like, and in hindsight, if you go look at the U.S. internet versus the Chinese internet, the indexes, it's just a fucking gap. Like it's a huge gap. And that always makes me nervous too, because the market, the markets just can't stay like that. But some of the stuff is just a little bit over my pay grade, and I'm just rebalanced personally how I think about, the companies that I want to own and not stress about, because I spend not enough time in the market and more time in the private markets. So I really appreciate that insight. And, people can follow you on Twitter, and you've been pretty open about your essays on this stuff. So internally, when this stuff type of happens and you take this hit, and I guess most of the hit was already taken because it hasn't been a good 6 months for Chinese stocks. What happens internally at a firm like yours? The news hits, what's it been like inside a firm that manages this type of money and has that exposure to China?
It's we're a young firm, right? We're 1 year old in business. And I would argue that, I hate to say this, but nothing. It's very calm. There's no panic. We had already started risk managing our positions many months ago. So we had big positions, but they were at much lower cost basis. And sometimes you get dealt a tough hand. And I've seen this many, many times in my life. I'm a pretty experienced portfolio manager. And, for me, what was really surprising and really kind of like made me happy, even though it was a tough few weeks, the team was just incredible. Like they were so mature. There was zero stress. Everyone was focused on getting their thing together. We actually, I actually found it great that as a team, we bonded even more closely. everyone was coming up with interesting things and how to interesting ideas. Like, how can we get ourselves out of this mess? Like, what is the opportunity set created now? And I was very grateful to see how the team bonded together, which I think is a sign of excellence in the long term for us. So I would say that, you know, nothing changed. We all came into work at as usual at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we got the news and we risk managed some positions and we rejigged our models. And we went through the list of 15 companies we cover, and we eliminated almost every one of them and ended up picking one idea that we really liked, and we sized it up. So in our business, and especially in the octahedron way of investing, is we don't panic and run around and try to do 10,000 different things in times of dislocation. It's mostly more calm, more focused, finding one or two great things we can do and taking advantage of distress in markets. And I think that playbook worked, you know, close to perfection. Now, we will see if the playbook is correct over the next 1 year. But, you know, internally, it was business as usual. Nothing changed.
What's great about the internet and the network is I can offload my China stuff to other people. And that's what's so great about the world that we live in. We can actually talk to these people in real time, and the people that are doing this stuff. I'm like, okay, you know, China beat me. Good one. But, you know, I have people that are working harder on that space and understand it better, and I'll just let them do their work and move on to stuff. It's always like what happens in a bull market is like you get sloppy. You end up saying you're concentrated, and I like to be concentrated, and you end up with 7,000 positions because the bull market has gone on longer than
and that's
so it's,
right.
So it's impossible to not have these blow-ups when a bull market goes on this long. So next up is Uber. I haven't thought about Uber in a while. And just because we're in a bull market and a lot of stocks are doing great. And Uber's just been in that like kind of a zone where it's peaked its head. It's survived the PR crisis of the switching at the top. And it seems rather calm. We don't hear anything about Uber. And so what brought that to your mind or your portfolio? Or how are you thinking about it?
You know, it struck me. So we've been buying more Uber stock because as we emerge from this crisis, I know that Delta variant is peaking its ugly head again, but there is, I would say, positive news coming out of Florida. The second derivative of change is slowing down. We saw what happened after, you know, COVID cases, you know, Delta COVID cases peaked in the UK. It came down quite dramatically. And, you know, I'm grateful and hopeful that more Americans will get vaccinated over time. We've started traveling this summer with the family. We feel reasonably safe traveling. The airports are in good shape. The planes are in good shape, in my opinion. And we've never felt unsafe traveling with or without the Delta variant. And so what's been frustrating to me is we were obviously that the stock is not only cheap, but I think it's extraordinarily cheap relative to a $100 billion of volume system that's going through the system right now. And, you know, what is interesting is obviously I've been involved with Uber since 2015. I led an investment for a previous firm 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, it's amazing to me. And the reason why it came to mind recently for us is, again, I tend to fill it and just, you know, put it to work. And, you know, we rarely kind of risk manage it, things too aggressively. But we started buying much more when it broke its IPO price again. This company has been out public for, I think, 3 years now, maybe 3.5 years now. And it's still below its IPO price, which is shocking.
Yeah.
Now, I know that they got hit hard by COVID. And I know that the management team did a few things in order to kind of like restructure the company and make sure that all the fat that had been accumulated over the years kind of like went away. But, you know, when a stock in a market like this, where things have just gone one way up to the right and Uber stock is below its IPO price and the management team is highly incentivized to get its stock price working, I'm just shocked at how badly the stock has done. And I would actually argue that once the transition happened, things became much more calm internally. But where I've been a little disappointed with is the quality of execution and some of the decisions made by the company reminds me in many ways of what this previous management did with Expedia. And Expedia was unfortunately a bit of a train wreck as a stock. right? And so I cannot help but being one of the biggest cheerleaders for Uber, because the reality is that, yes, they lose money on an EBITDA basis right now, but the unit economics are fantastic. The rides is one of the best business models I've seen in a long time. It's bad in the US, relatively speaking, but will still be a 30%+ margin business because we pay a lot for insurance in this country. But in some countries right now, you know, the long-term EBITDA, the contribution margin is well north of, you know, 40, 45, 50%. So it's a fantastic business model. And to that credit, Uber has done a really good job on Eats outside of the US. Eats outside the US is already profitable, but they are very sloppy in their execution of Eats in the US. The reality is that I am pretty convinced that they, now it's politically hard and it's going to be a hard pill to swallow, but Uber cannot ever at this point catch up with DoorDash. That is done. That story is done at this point.
Huh.
DoorDash has won in the US. There's no way that the delta between Uber and DoorDash now in terms of market share, I think it's more than 20 points.
And is that just because of focus? Like they just won DoorDash because they just...
DoorDash is an execution machine run by a brilliant founder, and his second-tier management team is one of the best I've seen in my life. Those guys are just execution beasts. They are very innovative. They're very smart and they're very aggressive. And Uber cannot lay a finger on them right now. So I say that, listen, Uber did the right thing, I'd say 2 years ago, where they said, listen, in every market, we want to be one or two. And where we are three, we're going to close the market and then not even focus. I thought that was very smart and very thoughtful. And that is why Uber, we all got excited about Uber, because we said, oh, this company is finally focusing. They're focusing on the rides business. They're focusing on the Eats business. And where they are number three or lower, they are closing those markets down, or they are doing some pretty smart, you know, JVs, or they own equity stakes in other companies and they're giving up on those markets. That's a smart, thoughtful capital allocation process. What has happened in recent months is I'm observing a complete change in focus, a little bit of arrogance, in my opinion, which dismays me. But, you know, yes, we all know that they all got hit by a very poor hand with COVID, right? Of course, volumes were down 70%. But even through that, you know, the naysayers of Uber stock, they haven't done the work. If you look at the unit economics of the rides business and you look at the underlying profitability and kind of how little they have to do in terms of volume to overcome the fixed costs, the ride sharing business is very, very good. Right? Now, obviously, in the second quarter, they miss numbers again, which, by the way, in my book is a complete, that's a sign of sloppy execution by management team when you miss your numbers. And they missed the numbers on profitability. And what is frustrating to me is in the US, you know, Uber rides are expensive. And part of the reason they're expensive is it's very hard to find labor. But when you pass such expensive costs down to your customers and you can't make your EBITDA numbers for rides, it's a question of, you know, either you're not communicating correctly to your shareholders or your execution is just not very good. Now, we're willing to look past this over the next two or three quarters because obviously they brought on a bunch of supply. These drivers are very happy. The supply stress is eased on them. Therefore, prices will go down for customers, and prices go down for customers, the demand will go up, and this entire market will start spinning again, especially as we come out of COVID. So I own a lot of the stock because I'm convinced that the rides business will do well over the next 12 months. And when that happens, it'll be so profitable that it'll overcome the entire loss-making portions of the business. And we'll come to that part, which is frustrating to me. And when that happens, when the company gets to a single dollar of free cash flow or a single dollar of EBITDA, which will happen, by the way, sometime this year, the stock will re-rate pretty dramatically because that's what happens when companies get to profitability. They re-rate their multiples, right? That's what happens. So that's the game we're playing. Where I think I am annoyed by their execution is the M&A acquisitions that they have done, right? So number one, Postmates was a disaster.
Huh.
Of course, they came up with a narrative as to why they did it. And now they have to defend the Postmates acquisition. It was done to own LA, and they're losing share in LA to DoorDash. And now they're going to spend money again to defend themselves. So that's number one. Number two is this recent acquisition on the freight business, which I think is fine, but freight has got nothing to do with your consumer marketplace. You know, think a little more thoughtfully on your capital allocation. Now, to their credit, I think the Corner Shop acquisition in whole is really good. And I think the Drizzly acquisition is also really good.
That one makes sense to me.
It makes a ton of sense. I think it's very smart. It's very thoughtful, mainly because with Drizzly, you get all the state licenses for alcohol. Mm-hmm. And with Corner Shop, you get a muscle that you never had before, which is convenience stores. However, buying and executing against a purchased asset is always hard. M&A comes with so much risk to it. I'm hopeful this management team has, they're very experienced in M&A, so I think they'll do a good job. But what I've still not heard from IR and the CFO is the targets and the expectations they've set for every new business they're acquiring and how are they marching towards those goals, right? They should kind of give confidence to the market that, you know, we're very thoughtful about how we do M&A. I believe they are, but they should talk about it. And that's missing. So that's number two. Now, number three, before I end with this is, you know, the delivery business, which is the Eats business, it's a good business, right? It's not going to be as great as the ride-sharing business. I think an old friend of mine did the math. I think we did the math internally and saw that, you know, for every ride share, they make 5 times the profit versus a single Eats order. Mm-hmm. So you want to double down on Eats and you want to double down on ride share and make sure the Eats business is relevant from a synergy perspective, from a customer acquisition perspective, and, you know, from a driver utilization perspective. Eats outside the US is profitable. It's a good business. Mm-hmm. And in many countries, they are number one, especially in Europe and some parts of Latin America and Japan. They're number one. The Eats business in the US is an unprofitable business. In the US, we have 3 players, generally speaking. We have DoorDash, which is a very clear leader. We've got Uber, which unfortunately gave up their first mover advantage and their scale. And then, of course, you have Grubhub, which is mostly coastal in nature, which I think has its own set of problems. So that's the setup in the US right now. And then you have what I call more niche kind of vertical players.
Yeah, like the GoPuff kids came in.
Well, no, not the Go. I'm just talking about the Eats business right now. We're not going to talk about convenience because Corner Shop competes with the convenience part of the business, right? So that's different altogether. And that's fine. GoPuff, Corner Shop, all are good things that, you know, Uber is very good at building these partnerships. So I'm happy with what they're doing there. But in the core Eats business, which is delivering from restaurants, they have no shot of becoming number one in the US. If you wanted to really be serious about investing in the US, you would take all those profits from international and you would execute a DoorDash-like play, which is long tail of towns and cities, and really build unbelievable infrastructure and invest in tech on Eats and utilization on Eats. And that's what you'd be doing.
Very interesting. I think for my listeners who love the markets and are always saying more of this, this is why it's really important to do some work. You know, there's a lot of people that just don't really dig in. In a world where so many things are working, why aggravate yourself with Uber? Like, what's the payday for you? Why waste your time? Why not pay up once they clean up the act? Because I agree with a lot of what you're saying, and the stock price is just an expression of all the things that you've just explained to me. Like, I could look at the chart and go, there's something going on at this company. It's trading below its IPO for 3 years. Well, the brand is up there with Coca-Cola and Bitcoin and Nike. Like, everybody's heard of it. You may have a feeling about it, good or bad, but it's just a miracle of a company. But I could have looked at the stock price and said, I'll revisit this at 60 because the market will have digested it. So what's the payday for you to do all this work and why even do it?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's funny. We often make this business harder than it should be. So then we start with a point of humility. But I would say, remember, your podcast is called Panic and you asked me what panics me. So this panics me, right? Yeah. So
good point.
It's not that the portfolio is all Uber, right? It's not
I understand.
Uber stuff. Yeah, we do have a bunch of incredible companies being run incredibly well, including we own DoorDash, we own Peloton, we own Yuen Man Man, we own C Limited, we own Netflix, we are building a position in Amazon. And so there are great companies in the world, but again, as you know, in every portfolio, at points in time, some companies don't work. And today, Uber is not working. Now, the only question to ask is, it's not about whether you own these stocks, because you always want to accumulate these stocks in points of distress, because the reality is we never know when these stocks will work. We do know that the management team is highly incentivized to build equity value for their shareholders based on the CEO's compensation. We know that the management team is experienced, usually thoughtful, and quite smart in what they do. And we know that the management team is surrounded by well-meaning, high-quality advisors. Mm-hmm. So if you take a one-year view or a two-year view, because remember, I cannot look only at the moment. Like right now, we're doing quite well, but I've got to look at what do I build into my portfolio today to make money on a prospective 12 to 18 months. As a professional money manager, this is not about making money in the moment and then selling it and, you know, taking some profits. It's about what portfolio do I have today that is performing well, but then will continue to perform well. Mm-hmm. And that's just a function of, and I, again, remember, yes, a company, a software company trading at 35 times revenues may keep staying at 35 and even go higher. But the reality is that that's a hope. That's not a plan. And then, you know, if anything happens on the yield curve or the Fed increases rates or the market just panics, those stocks are going to be down 50% while Uber is going to be down 10%. And so at any point in time as a professional money manager, and this is not relevant to, I think, retail investors, but it's still relevant for somebody managing their portfolio in an aggressive, kind of in a thoughtful and aggressive manner, you have to look forward to see that your portfolio is set up to return 25, 30, 40% that you want to in the prospective 12 months basis. And this is a lot like what I call delayed gratification.
Yeah. Well, that's why I allocate money to you and want to talk to you, is because I want to teach people that, like you said, thoughtful and aggressive.
Right. And you've got to be thoughtful and aggressive. You've got to, and therefore, the aggression part is important because generally the market is smarter than all of us put together. That's just the wisdom of the crowds. But ever so often you get gifts, right? And I think China is a gift to us right now. Everyone is panicking. Everyone is scared shitless. And therefore, it is incumbent on us to look to what is happening there. And as I told you before, again, we have sorted through all the regulatory crap, right? And we've come up with a framework, and we applied that framework to 12 companies we cover in China, and we found two ideas. Well, that's exactly what the octahedron kind of playbook is. You do all the work and you find one or two that may work, and you size it up and you check if your thesis is correct or wrong in the long term. Otherwise, you will end up, like you just mentioned a while ago, in a bull market, you'll end up with a 50 stock portfolio, and it all works when the markets are going up. But we've seen in March last this year, we've seen in September last year, November last year, that when the shit hits the fan, that's when you have true panic. And I would argue that if we were covering 50 or 60 stocks and we had these 1 and 2% positions, when the proverbial shit hit the fan in China, my team and me would be very stressed out. We would be actually panicking versus being very calm and, you know, putting the right bets in place for the future.
Is Netflix, so it's in my portfolio, it's in my 8 to 80. I'm patient as hell. They don't seem to be doing anything wrong. I know the metaverse and now they got into gaming. Is that a mistake or is that inevitable? And do I just remain patient? Like, I go home and the last two, and again, I'm wrong all the time. So I've been super, super wrong with one of my ideas, Spotify. I mean, I've been right in terms of long-term I'm up, but for anybody that's listened to me over the last 6 months, because it's in my 8 to 80 portfolio, it's befuddling. And I know why it's befuddling. It's shit margins. They're dealing with the fucking royalty world. So shame on me. But Netflix is spending money to create content, and kind of they're the opposite of Spotify. But both seem to be, obviously Spotify worse than Netflix, struggling. And I can't put my finger on it because they are both the apps that I use the most. Therefore, I'm most comfortable owning them. So what am I doing? What am I thinking about wrong here? Forget Spotify because you don't own it, but Netflix. What's the next big thing for them? Because I'm super bullish.
Yeah. If you look at the 5-year chart of Netflix, you know, nobody's going to say you're doing badly, Howard, because the stock is within 5% of its all-time highs, right? Yeah. So the market's reflecting kind of the view you have. I think what you're specifically saying is, man, in the last 12 months, Netflix and Amazon haven't moved, right? Netflix is basically flat at 500 and Amazon is basically flat at 3000. Mm-hmm. That is the frustration I think you're more accurately describing. So when stocks go sideways for a while, my general view is if it's an excellent management team, an excellent business model, with a long runway to grow. These are the times the markets are digesting data points and they are giving you a bit of a gift. So for Netflix in specific, we're looking for two things. Everyone's grumpy right now because in the short term, they missed their net adds number, I think, for Q2. And they basically said that a new content slate is coming up at the back half of the year. And when the new content slate comes up, they'll put more money in marketing. And they were, let's be real, they are comping very difficult comps from last year. Everybody sat in their houses last year and turned on Netflix. And now many people are not turning on Netflix. The reality is that in 6 months, you expect that management team will put out world-class content. And when they put on world-class content, people will re-engage with the product. And now that Netflix does not allow you to share passwords anymore, everyone will be forced to buy their own passwords. That'll increase the net adds in the US. And oh, by the way, the company will never take on any more debt or any more dilution anymore because they will be free. They'll be running free cash flow positive as a company. As far as the eye can see, they've actually said that in many words. The stock raised, I think, at 6.5 times net revenues. And so I think nothing's going to change in Netflix. This is the thing where you be patient and you hold this position. And if it goes down, the market gives you a gift.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with Amazon. Amazon, it's very interesting. I think Amazon is one of those, at this point, no-brainer ideas.
Yeah, because still a no-brainer.
Amazon, for 2 quarters, has accelerated AWS revenues. Accelerated. You know, 8 years ago, my old boss at Bernstein and I wrote the seminal book on cloud on Wall Street. It's this classic, what I call Bernstein Black Book, where we basically discovered that hiding inside a 5 or 6% margin retail business was a 30% plus Amazon web services business. And in 2012, when he published the Black Book, and I'll send you a copy at some point, we had basically shown that Amazon would be a 30% Amazon margin business, but we'll get to a scale of $20 billion by 2020. And it seemed absurd to talk about $20 billion of IT spend on Amazon sitting back in 2012. Today, the company is doing $60 billion in AWS on a run rate basis, and the margins are 30%. And their ads business has accelerated again 2 or 3 quarters in a row. That's an absolute monster. And if you look at Google's earnings, you'll basically see that SMBs and retail are driving, and travel, of course, driving a lot of volumes on Google. And that's the same driving volumes on Amazon. And what people are grumpy about is, you know, a slowing of the core business in both first party and third party cases. But the reality is, look at what happened last year. You cannot comp that level of growth. The world came to an abrupt stop and Amazon had to scale everything up. The second reason why people are grumpy on Amazon is they said, oh, by the way, you're going to spend all this money on new CapEx in order to put money into logistics. And that reduces your free cash flow over the next couple of years. I'm like, they should absolutely do that because the existential threat for Amazon, which is the reason why we're so bullish on DoorDash, is Amazon build their business on price, selection, and convenience. They still win on price. They still win on selection. Where they are losing out is on convenience, especially for high-frequency goods. Today on Instacart, you can order from Best Buy and get your set of AirPods within 2 hours. In Amazon, it'll take you 2 days from now, and so on and so forth. And so they are losing the convenience battle. It's just a fact in the US. And with all the money going into Gopuff and Gorillas in the UK, et cetera, you know, they are losing the, you know, that cornerstone bodega kind of, or the Walgreens, or the, you know, drive out 10 minutes to pick it up kind of purchases, which used to be all on Amazon, I'd say 2 years ago. So of course they should build out volumes. They should get 80% of their users covered within 1 day or less. And they should get 25 to 30% covered within 4 hours or less.
Got it.
They should of course do that. And if you are grumpy that they're spending money on building up infrastructure for long-term equity value creation, that's fine with me because the world is giving us a gift. This is different than, and this is why I'm frustrated with Uber, back to that point, is Uber seems to be wanting to spend money on stuff that is not long-term equity value creative. That is the frustrating part.
Yeah. So here's, I'm going to clarify some of my own thoughts from this. When I hear the word no-brainer and I hear it all day on StockTwits and Twitter, I run. But
yeah,
I have an 80-80 list and it's kind of like a no-brainer list. So I'm left with, in the world that we live in today, I have six names on my no-brainer list. They're the largest positions I have. I keep curating it down. I get more nervous because they seem more like no-brainers than ever before. And my list of no-brainers, post-China, post-stock, because to be honest, Tencent was on my no-brainer list and is completely off my list right now. But I have Nike, Google, Amazon, Shopify, Netflix, Apple. So just Nike, Google, Amazon, Shopify. Because I'm constantly pruning and testing myself because I have people that follow me and trust me for their ideas. And I like doing this, even though it's free. Nike, Google, Amazon, Shopify, Netflix, Apple. Do any of those names scare you as not no-brainers?
Except for Apple, which I think always has made, again, I have a very different view on Apple because I've just been an Apple. I'm a bull on the stock. I'm not a big fan of their products, but I know I'm in the minority there. So ignore me completely.
Okay.
But literally every other name there is fantastic. I would say that if you had to put me on the spot and give me my no-brainer list, it would be DoorDash. It would be Zoom, Shopify, Square, PayPal. For me, it's Peloton as well. Carvana, Twilio, Unity Software are on my list. In addition, I don't do much consumer. I'm not very smart on consumer, so I don't know much there. But you know, Nike is an amazing asset. In fact, we've been thinking about should we be covering Nike as a firm, especially as you know now a material portion of sales. I think north of 30-40% of Nike sales get done online.
Correct.
So is this a e-commerce company number? Is it a brand?
Well, I have this thing called, I'm interrupting, I apologize.
No, not at all.
Nike's fashion. So I'm thinking of adding, and I wrote about it last night in preparation for this because I've just been excited to talk to you, I'm never going to agree with you on, so to your Apple, I'm saying DoorDash. So we both get, first of all, I'm going to create a no-brainer list. I'm going to partner with you on a no-brainer list. It's free. We make no claims that I'd love to partner with you on a trademark, a no-brainer list.
Yeah, but again,
list.
I have to give you the legal disclaimer saying
Of course. I'm saying you and I, for fun, I want to just create a no-brainer, equal weighted. Well, the disclaimers will be long. It'll be 900 pages of disclaimer and our list.
Good. Very good.
Because
on that list, I would put Amazon and Google as well.
Yeah, so Square, Ryan Gilbert, my partner and LP and working with me on some new stuff, he's owned that since the beginning and it just fucking makes fun of me every day because he bites his tongue because he knows I hate Jack. It's cost me a fortune to hate Jack on this one. I'll never come over the side. I think I've never seen Cash App in the wild. I don't think there's anything unique about Square. And now they bought a buy now, pay later lending commodity type business. And I just continue to be wrong. So that's what I love about your list, that it's a no-brainer to you and it's a full-brainer. It's making me insane. I own Peloton. I own Twilio. I own Zoom. I guess I should say Zoom is on my no-brainer list. So thank you. Carvana, is it because of TAM?
So again, to be clear, this no-brainer list has got nothing to do with valuation, right?
Yeah, okay. So it's just no-brainer list in terms of it's just an incredible product and business?
An incredible product, incredible company, A-plus management team, and there is no slowing down inside.
Unbelievable. It's in our backyard here, Knut.
Yeah, it is.
It was like the ugly duckling guy.
So believe it or not, we are, you know, talk about big mistakes in life. You know, we met Ernie and Mark.
Yeah, because Ernie's got like a mixed... you know, local reputation.
You know, my view is, you know, I've been a short seller for long enough to know when the short sellers are correct and when it's utter bullshit. And in the case of Carvana, it seemed a lot like emotional negativity behind Ernie because of the history of the company versus any factual. And when I defended the company internally at a previous firm, I said, you do not blame the son for the sins of the father. This guy's
got otherwise, even Howard Lindzen may have a little trouble. My old hometown in Toronto.
There you go, right? So, no, but it's just that, you know, they continue to impress on execution. And the reason why for me,
yes,
again, I'm a big fan of the companies that just say X and do X plus 5, and they just work like clockwork.
And the customer has never said something nice about a car company, including Tesla. And Carvana, right. I never hear anything bad about Carvana other than valuation.
I use Carvana all the time. you know, especially as my family grew, we had to move from a Prius to a small SUV to a large SUV. And Carvana is just a freaking delight. I enjoy it.
We're going to take our stock picking set and call it No-Brainer Vana.
Okay. There you go.
So PayPal, I agree. 100%. I owned it forever and I just sold it based on valuation. Dumbbell that I am. I see that you don't. Do you think MasterCard and Visa are now beyond, like, Square absolutely, and PayPal?
Absolutely no-brainers, except for the fact that we don't own it because I tend to own companies that grow fast, and MasterCard and Visa do not grow fast. They grow at 15% or less. So we typically don't own companies that grow less than 15% per year.
And that's why I probably never stayed with PayPal long enough here in the last year, is that I always felt they're built on the rails of Visa and MasterCard. But I just... Again, it's hard to call something a no-brainer, as we see. Like, our lists are long.
It's always hard. I remember many years ago, I had this, we used to call the trillion-dollar challenge when trillion-dollar companies were difficult to come by. I remember how confidently 3 years or 4 years ago, before this entire management change happened, to be clear, for all the right reasons, because, you know, unfortunately, you know, Uber was what I call, you know, poorly run in a previous generation. They were executing well, but poorly run business, if you know what I mean. And I understand what happened there. But I would say that Uber was my no-brainer $1 trillion business. And gosh, have I been wrong. It's only now 94% away from that target.
So I just think there's so many ways to look at the investing world. So I really appreciate your insights. I'm going to end with one question, and maybe we won't talk about it, but I want to talk about SPACs because you can short and you're a hedge fund. And I think when I last talked to you, you said it was just going to be a fun time shorting these. I think I remember you saying that. Is that something that you got short on just because of, like, the whole fucking sector, or did you stay away from it?
There are never what I call blanket rules on anything. For me, everything at a price. You know, it's all about stock picking, right?
Yeah.
So I would say the reason I was grumpy on SPACs a while ago was I found that the quality of SPACs were just poor. Now, for every, I think, like, I would say 80% of SPACs were companies that were just poor assets, and kind of, I was dismayed by the fact that very highly respectable people used the SPACs as a way to personally enrich themselves and effectively act as pipe pipers and just, you know, just do things that I do not want to be involved with. Mm-hmm. But for everything else, there are rules, right? And there are specific cases where SPACs actually make a ton of sense, especially for incredible businesses that are hot tech and find it hard to find raising money in growth markets. I find SPACs are actually quite thoughtful and quite useful if done right. And so a lot of companies come to us and ask us, hey, should I go the SPAC route or the direct listing route? Or should I, you know, all the options they have right now. And I say it often comes down to it depends, unfortunately. It depends on, are you able to find a high quality, thoughtful, well-aligned SPAC sponsor? Are you able to find a valuation that you're not able to get in the public markets via a traditional IPO? And so on and so forth, right? And so we have actually invested in two or three SPACs, both in the pipe, both in the IPO. And then after the de-SPAC happened, we own three SPACs right now. Again, we don't own them in size. They are smaller positions and startup positions for us, but we do own them. And so I wouldn't say that everything is negative. We were short a lot of SPACs in the past. And I think the euphoria has come out of many SPACs right now. So it's difficult to short them at the moment. So we're not involved on the short side anymore. But we're actually looking, and again, like everything else in life, our job is to look across the debris and see if we find diamonds in the rough.
I think there's so much debris here all of a sudden that there's going to be some opportunity.
Yeah, so this blanket idea, you know, when I see these blanket statements on Twitter that everything is bad or everything is good, it annoys me because it's all about facts, circumstance, and nuance. And, you know, for me, you know, we tend to, you know, work with probably the best of breed, and there probably three or four SPAC sponsors I trust, and we will only work with them, and only if they find us a phenomenal asset and if they don't overpay for it, right? And that combination is hard. I suspect that because we have so many, you know, these high quality sponsors have a bunch of SPACs out there, and now that the demand supply imbalance is now coming back in check. My suspicion is on the in the prospective 12 to 18 months, there will be interesting assets to buy.
Yep.
But I don't have a religious view on SPACs being bad or SPACs being good. I suspect all of that, the stuff you hear on Twitter and general mass media, is just jealousy that the sponsor, you know, does quite well on a SPAC. And I'm like, I have no problem with the sponsor as well. He or she is doing a lot of work to bring a company public, and they take a lot of risk on their own books. So I have no problem with that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a sponsor, and we did it all for the right reasons, and I've just watched this play 100%. Out. I've watched this play out, and I'm like, God, why was I thinking? Because I'm like, I want to be the good guy, and there's just so many bad actors so quickly.
There's so many bad actors. Oh, but I do think, though, if you can be that one handful of good actors, I think you will shine.
Yeah, I'm not worried about it. I just am bummed. But that's how financial markets work. Ben Hunt calls them raccoons. It's a raccoon industry. They're there. It's just like garbage. You know, you have garbage out there and raccoons are there. And I think it's just one of the most interesting moments in investing time. Last thought, Robinhood, were you impressed by the IPO? Do you think it was interesting the way they did the distribution to invest? You know, I'm biased, but I wanted to get your take.
Yeah, I actually am quite optimistic on Robinhood. I just saw the amount. So generally, my psychology is such that I tend to go against the grain. And I would say that the Robinhood IPO was almost universally negative, including on the roadshow. And I gave a fair bit of feedback to the management team through a few friends who are involved in the board and who are involved in the private markets. But I would say that all things considered, I like the fact that for me, the biggest issue with Robinhood is the dependence on PFOF for revenues and the dependence on, I don't think it goes away. I think it's going to be fine. For me to grow into the valuation that the company ended up at, and the company is at right now, I think it's at $50 a share and change. I would love to see them transform to a holistic kind of financial kind of like one-stop shop for consumers versus just trading alone, which is great, but I don't think that in itself is a sufficient condition to own the stock in size. But I tend to be quite optimistic on the company as a whole. And I would say that gun to head, I think they did a reasonable job. The IPO was not excessively priced. In fact, the IPO broke its initial price for a couple of days, and then it went racing up again. It falls for me in the too expensive bucket to take a big position right now. Let's put it that way.
Now, my take was, and I'll let you go, my take was more about, like, I thought it was just risky and impressive in the world that Google did a Dutch auction, and Gurley talks about direct listings in a world of SPACs and a world of Goldman still at all-time highs in a world where we're bitching at Robinhood for, you know, transgressions, let's call them what they are, you know, PR, communication, business model. You know, when I invested, I didn't have all those concerns. But to go and do what they did is just, I think we're going to look back and go, yeah, I can't believe we're worried about PFOF. They're the next they're Goldman Sachs.
I think you're going to be right. In fact, my instinct is you're going to be totally right. I do like the company. You know, again, I tend to have a bias to younger founder-led companies who are basically in it to win it. And I would argue that Robinhood absolutely kind of, displays that kind of aggression and kind of that ambition to build something really impactful. And they will get there. They'll get there. It's I'm favorably biased towards Robinhood.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, like, 300,000 people got shares of their IPO. Schwab, E-Trade had those opportunities over 20 years with tech and their brand to go try something bold, and they never did. And I just think the media missed the complete point of talking about payment for order flow. Well, they pulled off a better IPO than Facebook did with the help of the NASDAQ. Robinhood took so much brand risk to get shares into the hands, and all the media was focused on was the wrong thing. So I thought the sentiment was bananas there.
Absolutely was bananas. And, but, you know, shame on me for not taking a bigger stab at this one when it broke IPO issue. But
look at it post. Yeah. Like I wavered and then bought more. And even though I own enough, and it was a great trade.
It was a phenomenal trade. So congrats on that. No, we were dealing with a lot of China at the time. So we're a small and young team. So we have to focus on what we know. And I'd say that we missed Robinhood, which was a bummer. because I've been trying to buy that company for years.
Well, it's a great way to end it. This was a, you never can get this stuff right. All you can do is have a process, and it's just great to catch up. You know, it's been a while. The markets are quite interesting, so it feels good to catch up on all this list and go through no-brainers and China and Uber and processes. So I appreciate your time, and we'll see you on Twitter.
No, I appreciate that, Howard. And as you know, whenever we talk about no-brainers, we're going to be wrong. So let's prepared for that.
Yeah, no-brainers and in brackets, wrong.
Exactly.
All right, buddy. Talk soon.
Thanks for having me.
K-Nut.
Yeah.
See, I could do this stuff all day. I just don't know what my listeners could care less.
No, he's got a great take on things all the time. He's so deeply invested.
Well, he's got skin in the game and enough that it's stressful. He's done. It's not an easy life.
No.
Being questioned every minute about your positions, which is why I love the private markets more than I did the public markets, because I used to have to deal with what he just dealt with me. He's getting put on the spot all the time. And to you, stop putting me on the spot.
Okay.
You should be nicer now knowing what it's like.
Yeah, no.
Although you're a great investor to the point where like, can I give you an update? No, I trust you. You know, you should be more
My investment advice is always to myself as we've been, ask Howard how much you have in it. I'm going to have a little piece.
So there you have it, and it's worked for you.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. By the way, that's just extra pressure on me. Even though you're doing it for the right reasons, I take that pressure seriously, and that's why I look as badly as I do. So. Okay,
I'll get you an extra Ambien.
So that was fun. Hopefully people enjoyed that. I think take a step back and really think about who you're competing against. It's funny, you know, you can go on Reddit or StockTwits or Twitter and just get into arguments. Or you can lean back and try and find people like Rom or use me to Peloton your way into, not that Rom, like you just said, the no-brainer lists are wrong. The wisdom of the crowd is just tough to beat.
The no-brainers never listen to the no-brainer advice.
Correct. And markets are just, will just fuck you up. And there is no perfect training for this. So hopefully people appreciated that. And so this is Panic with Friends. We talk to traders like Rom, hedge fund managers, investors, entrepreneurs, trying to get one or two steps ahead. We don't need to be 10 steps ahead. And we're trying to build a Peloton to help us move quicker in our learning curve investing. And I think we've proven through COVID and 18 months of doing this podcast that the best ideas are probably just there in plain sight. Maybe not quite no-brainers, but if you really look at the trends in the underlying business, you can make things too complicated. So you can find me, Howard Lindzen, Spotify, Apple, Google, wherever your favorite investing app, subscribe. Once a week, Thursday, Knut and I and crew come out with a podcast with people like Rom. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Tell your friends, subscribe, and we will see you next week.
Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.